Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth.
Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. In this episode, we'll feature the first part of a two-part presentation I gave, entitled Corporate Media Control and Media Reform Struggles. But first, a collection of recent news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
I'm Fraley Nord.
I'd like to call the Subcommittee on Communications and Technology to order. Today we have a hearing and a markup on network neutrality and HJ Res 37, the resolution of disapproval I introduced to stop the FCC from regulating the Internet.
With his resolution of disapproval, Committee Chairman Greg Walden, a Republican from Oregon, opened the door even wider for more corporate abuse of the Internet. The resolution would strip the Federal Communications Commission of its authority to protect Internet users and give phone and cable companies unrestrained power to block services like online video and audio and restrict free speech. Throughout the hearing, Walden and others spoke of the Internet as if it were never regulated.
We have an open and thriving Internet thanks to our historical hands-off approach. The Internet works pretty well. It's the government that doesn't.
Mike Doyle, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, was clearly frustrated.
You know, up till 2005, the transmission component of DSL service was regulated as a telecommunications service. In the dial-up world, companies provided data transmission. They were obviously regulated as a telecommunications service because the data traveled over phone lines. So, you know, to keep hearing statements that you know, there was never any regulation of the Internet and it worked just peachy keen, it just isn't based in any reality.
Free Press Research Director Derek Turner talked about the lack of competition for Internet service and called for a different kind of reality check.
If we can agree that ensuring access to an open platform is a worthy policy goal, then we have a duty to confront the reality that network owners have strong incentives to close the platform and favor their own content at the expense of everyone else's.
California's Anna Eshoo said she was fascinated by her Republican colleagues' determination to remove authority over the Internet.
Because the stakeholders themselves are on the other side of the issue. The letters that have poured into this committee of groups and organizations across the country, from religious leaders to consumer organizations to high technology associations, they have all weighed in and said, don't do this.
The resolution of disapproval passed the committee along party lines, 15-8. It's expected to pass the House. It will then move to the Senate.
I think there's a virus here in Congress, and it really is not about net neutrality. I think it's about any kind of regulation and whether government agencies have authority to carry out rules through their regulations. I think that's really what's at the heart of this thing.
It's a common complaint across the country. There's not enough real news on the news today. But people disappointed by mainstream media's coverage in their communities have an opportunity to fill that need. Low-powered FM radio. The National Radio Project is one such effort, illuminating social justice issues and giving voice to perspectives often excluded from mainstream news.
It could be environment, it could be war, it could be racism, it could be racial profiling. We're doing a show right now about gang injunctions. It could be media issues and the need for net neutrality.
That's Andrew Stelzer, a producer for the National Radio Project based in Oakland, California. His work has aired nationally and internationally, gaining the attention of programs like NPR's Weekend Edition, Studio 360, and World Radio Switzerland.
We produce our show a couple weeks ahead of time, so it's not usually going to be the news of the day, but maybe stepping back and taking a larger look at the issues and how they relate to different communities and what kind of groups around the country and around the world really are organizing and how they're organizing to try to give the people some influence on important issues of the day.
Before the National Radio Project, Stelzer worked with WMNF in Tampa, where he helped create a successful community radio station that built a robust news department.
And it became influential in influencing the public conversation around issues in Tampa and the Tampa Bay area at large.
Stelzer will be speaking about his experiences at the upcoming National Conference for Media Reform.
There are going to be most likely hundreds, if not thousands, of small, low-powered radio stations opening up around the country, mostly in rural communities away from the big city. What I'm going to be talking about is my belief that these stations should, whatever the word invest means, they should invest in news and producing local news for their community.
Stelzer will join hundreds of other engaging and dynamic activists, journalists, educators, and media reformers at the 2011 National Conference for Media Reform. You can catch him at 9 a.m. on Saturday, April 9th, to hear more about investing in communities through low-power radio. Check out conference.freepress.net for more details.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
On the 8th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, the M19 anti-war mobilization will host a rally and march demanding an end to the wars and occupations abroad, an end to political repression, and an end to corporate welfare at home. The rally, with live music and speakers, begins at 12 noon on Saturday, March 19th at downtown Chicago, Michigan Avenue and Congress Parkway, followed by a march up Michigan Avenue to Water Tower Park, where a second rally will be held. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripajczyk. We now feature the first part of a two-part presentation I gave entitled Corporate Media Control and Media Reform Struggles. The following presentation was given at Third Unitarian Church in Chicago on Sunday, January 16th, 2011.
The title of this presentation, as Laurel had mentioned, is indeed Corporate Media Control and Media Reform Struggles. So, I will provide a capsule history of media in the United States, focusing on the corporate control of media domestically and the struggles to counter that corporate control running through to the present day, even alluding to events that occurred last month. This presentation is divided roughly by medium: print and newspapers first, then the telegraph, the telephone, movies, radio, television, what I call cross-media concentration, and the internet, with some summarizing remarks at the end. I will keep a roughly chronological flow in this presentation, though I reserve the right to time travel, jumping on occasion from the past to the future and back again. I want to share with you a sampling of the work on struggling for a better medium in the United States, with the hopes of inspiring you to join the work and empowering you with this story, especially given the central role that media play in all struggles for a better tomorrow and the successes that we have won, with hopefully more successes to come. We begin our story with the founding of the first national media network in the United States, though many people today don't consider it a media resource. Yet it was incredibly critical for forging an open and diverse discourse in the early United States for the better part of 70 years. I'm referring to the post office. Most of the post office's traffic before 1840 was newspapers. Indeed, the percentage of postal traffic that comprised newspapers that the Postal Service sent grew from 70%, 70, in 1794 to 90% in 1832. Indeed, in the early days of the American Republic, it was a given that a democratic society required as wide a realm of discourse as possible, and that the post office should be subsidized by the government to help to encourage that discourse. Some even thought that all postal traffic should always be free, but nevertheless, a modest tax was implemented. Indeed, many social justice movements of the early 19th century, including the growing abolitionist movement, credited these post office subsidies for the growth of their own media and, as a result, their own social justice efforts. There's a connection with the 19th century newspaper industry, jumping up a little bit ahead, and the telegraph, which we'll see in a moment. The modern electric telegraph was patented in 1844 by Samuel Morse. Morse, with the help of advances in the science of electricity and other technical advances, was able to perfect the single-wire telegraph, allowing for far faster communications than ever before. But the fate of its widespread use, unlike that of the post office, which was nationalized, was not slated for nationalization by an indifferent Congress in 1844, as well as facing the growing power of capital in 19th century America. Instead, the telegraph was subject to market whims, at first with more than 50 different telegraphy firms, which ultimately consolidated into just one company, Western Union. Critics had feared that a monopoly of the telegraph could lead to unfair advantages in stock transactions. But another problem regarding corporate control of the news via telegraph would also emerge, starting from a coalition of five New York newspapers who pooled their funds in 1846 to share the cost of telegraph time for the transfer of urgent news. This group called itself the New York Associated Press, which grew over time to encompass more than just New York, in fact the entire country, dropping the New York part of its name, becoming the Associated Press, and working out an exclusive arrangement with Western Union to become the only newswire service in the United States. From 1880 to 1910, calls for nationalization of the telegraph began to grow as part of the general populist movement of efforts in the United States at the time. There were calls to raise what was called the infernal bondage between the AP and Western Union. In response, some 70 congressional bills were introduced between 1866 and 1900 calling for telegram reform, including even nationalization of the telegram. Western Union lobbyists wound up defeating all 70 of those bills. And the newspapers, especially those aligned with the Associated Press, refused to accede to the question of nationalizing the telegraph, understandably so given the dependence on the telegraph for news. Around the same time, a new medium, not one primarily restricted to big newspapers, stock traders, and other if-faith groups, would extend to a greater portion of the population than the telegraph ever did. That medium, ironically enough, stemmed directly from attempts to advance the technology of the telegraph, one of whose pioneers was a professor of phonetics at Boston University named Alexander Graham Bell. Bell, and particularly Bell's father-in-law, Gardner Green Hubbard, who had far more of a nose for business than Bell ever did, wound up winning the patent wars for an advance of what was referred to as the harmonic telegraph. It's the idea of transmitting multiple different telegraph signals, or harmonics, across a single wire. But those harmonics can also carry individual sound frequencies, like those of the human voice, and it ultimately became known as the telephone. By 1877, the Bell Telephone Company and its successor in the wake of a number of intervening mergers, the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, or AT&T, would itself become a behemoth thanks to monopoly control of that patent. But after the telephone patent wound up expiring in 1894, many, many aspiring telephone groups and cooperatives entered the fray. The independents, as they were called, would go on to expand telephone service across the country, particularly in rural environments, which were often ignored as not being enough of a lucrative market for AT&T. The independents at their peak held some 40% of the overall telephone market and were starting to do something that AT&T did not do, innovate. By 1908, AT&T was in trouble, and that's when AT&T President Theodore Vail began to act. He deployed a PR offensive with a slogan touting universal service. He bought out some of those independent telephone companies, and he sublicensed with others for technical preference. That and a growing unease with dual service, it's important to note that the phone lines by AT&T and by the independents were incompatible, so that required every household to practically have two separate phone lines. All of that helped to turn the tide, so much so that by 1920, AT&T controlled 66% of the market, and by 1932, 81% of the market. And it wouldn't look back until even the 1980s, when an antitrust settlement finally broke the AT&T monopoly. During the early 20th century, both the growing telephone industry and the shrinking telegraph industry were facing another rival that neither industry could do: show moving pictures. The movie environment, in the days of the silent film era, from 1900 to about 1920, was markedly wide open, where neighborhood theaters sprouted up and the cost of producing short films was rather low. Thus, many people entered the game of producing and showing films, including a great many political activists making films related to one or another cause, including labor activism, women's suffrage, and political radicalism. The first factor in the change of this environment was what was called the Edison Trust, an effort to monopolize control of American film stock owned by Thomas Edison. But the Edison Trust was stymied by independent film efforts, the growth of new longer feature films, and the continuing growth of theaters to show those films. The victory over the Edison Trust wound up becoming utterly total. Not only was the trust put on the defensive and ultimately terminated by a court in 1918, by 1925, all of the companies comprising the trust went out of business. Yet those independents would, from 1920 to 1930, become the new status quo, with an influence far greater than the Edison Trust ever held. I'm referring to the studio system of movies. What became the studio system began by an orphaned Hungarian emigre and furrier named Adolf Zukor. Zukor and his business partners opened a chain of film arcades along the east coast of the United States. Then they organized a film production company called the Famous Players Film Company, then signed a distribution contract with Paramount, and through various maneuvers secured control of all avenues of producing, of making movies, production, distribution, and theaters, far more than the Edison Trust ever held. That formation of Paramount spurred a trend of consolidation within the film industry in the 1920s. And many of the main players in what would become the studio system came from hardscrabble backgrounds like Zukor. Harry Warner, a founder of Warner Brothers, was an emigre clothier from Poland who got into films when a Nickelodeon opened near his store and did better business than his clothing store. William Fox was another Hungarian emigre who got into textiles, and he sold his whole textile company just to start his first Nickelodeon. They and a handful of others stood atop the eight film companies from the ensuing consolidation. The Big Five, as they were known, Fox, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Radio Keith Orpheum, or RKO, and Lowe's, the parent of MGM, as well as three other majors, as they were called, Universal, Columbia, and United Artists. As part of their effort against the Edison Trust, these independents, although they would become the studio system, used the production of longer feature films, which by virtue of their length cost more and required more film. That, among other factors, resulted in forming barriers to entry in the film market. Films that could be produced for perhaps $1,000 in 1920 would, by 1930, cost upwards of $40,000. Not to mention the new requirements for this newfangled technology, sound. The Jazz Singer, the very first sound feature film feature the feature sound in 1927, cost $500,000 to produce. That and the creation of elegant movie palaces by the studio system across America raised the ante for costs further. Labor unions and radicals simply couldn't afford to compete with higher costs. Many radical and oppositional filmmakers struggled to survive, and a lot simply dropped out. Mind you, in 1928, this could have changed dramatically despite these attacks. A proposal by a single movie electrician, Patrick Murphy, could have turned America's labor temples, then about 1,500 in number, into the largest movie distribution chain in America. But labor leaders at the time, unfortunately, were dismissive. They regarded this proposal as secondary to the work of real organizing efforts, not sympathetic with the potential of movies to inspire and encourage activism. And with labor rank and file not willing or able to force the matter on the table, the studio system was ultimately triumphant. It was around the same time when yet another new medium caught the attention of a nation and a movement for media reform struggles. The struggle over radio in the 1920s and 30s may have been the high watermark in media reform struggles in American history. Radio in the 1920s was dominated by hundreds of nonprofits and universities, but a court ruling in 1926 invalidated all radio licenses since there was no congressional authority to grant radio licenses. That led to a free-for-all of the radio spectrum, and Congress, in response, hurriedly passed the Radio Act of 1927, which authorized a new government commission, the Federal Radio Commission, or FRC, to authorize new radio licenses. The FRC was dominated by commercial interests related to radio manufacturing, and its general counsel was Chicago Tribune Corporation Lewis Caldwell. He was an attorney with the Tribune. And there was a wide distaste for advertising on radio despite this commercial involvement. Skepticism even arose that advertising could provide enough of a viable funding base. Nevertheless, the FRC joined up with the Trade Association of Commercial Broadcasting, the National Association of Broadcasters. It was actually founded in Chicago at the Drake Hotel in 1922, and I like to refer to them as the National Association of Bastards. The NAB, as they were called, along with two incipient radio networks, the National Broadcasting Company, which was the result of RCA buying out AT&T's broadcasting properties, and the Columbia Broadcasting System, which was bought and nurtured by another Chicago guy, a Chicago-born cigar manufacturer's son named William Paley. CBS NBC and the NAB wound up crafting, with almost no outside involvement, a 1928 reallocation of radio licenses to give the choicest frequencies and strongest broadcast strengths to commercial broadcasters. As a result of this, for the next 7 years, a coalition of civic groups fought back and included educators like a coalition founded in Chicago in 1930, the National Coalition for Education on Radio, as well as organized labor exemplified by WCFL, a Chicago radio station owned and run by the Chicago Federation of Labor, hence the call letters WCFL, along with religious groups exemplified perhaps best by the Missionary Society of St. Paul the Apostle of New York, better known as the Paulist Fathers, who ran their own radio station. They were all inspired by the positive potential of radio and examples of national nonprofit radio broadcasters like the BBC in Britain and the CBC in Canada. The U.S. commercial broadcasters responded to this challenge with fierceness. They undercut the opposition, set up front groups, granted broadcast time to politicians, saw their audience widen while the opposition's audience shrank, won the critical support of the newspaper industry, and defeated lobbying efforts by community groups in the early 1930s on Capitol Hill for broadcast reform. Reform efforts nevertheless continued, including a 1934 amendment which would have allotted 25% of all radio frequencies in the country to be placed under nonprofit use, and which came very close to becoming law. But that commercial lobbying blitz was able to defuse those efforts, including the use of a rigged 1934 hearing and the 1934 Communications Act, which replaced the FRC with a new Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, and placed as sacrosanct the commercial bias of broadcasting. The coalition of civic groups unraveled, some disbanded, and the dream of national nonprofit radio was dead. But the complaints continued, and the FCC was shamed into some reform actions. Antitrust sentiment in the 1940s resulted in an FCC report on chain broadcasting, which led to NBC spinning off one of its radio networks to become the American Broadcasting Company. You know it as ABC. And a portion of the new FM radio band was allotted to non-commercial broadcasters. That's how the Pacifica Radio Network began in the 1940s by Quaker pacifist Lou Hill, and would serve as a beacon for improving radio and ultimately broadcasting. But as focus turned from radio to television, and I'll be talking a lot about TV in a bit, the relative influence of radio wound up to shrink, and radio stations started gaining more local autonomy, but still remained for the most part commercially based. The 1980s, jumping a little bit ahead, saw the emergence of what's called low-power FM radio, LPFM, which helped to restore the community nonprofit potential of radio. This was in no small part thanks to the reduced cost of radio broadcasting equipment and to the efforts of activists like Free Radio Berkeley founder Stephen Dunifer, and to a blind activist, Imbana Kantako, who used a 1-watt radio transmitter to broadcast to his public housing project in Springfield, Illinois. The FCC cracked down on unlicensed LPFM broadcasters, but it was too easy to start new LPFM stations, and so the FCC found it increasingly hard to crack down everyone. So the FCC ultimately proposed, and wound up passing into law, a licensed LPFM service, which passed Congress in 2000. But thanks to a sneaky lobbyist maneuver enacted overnight, the number of potential radio stations was reduced from thousands to hundreds. Nevertheless, LPFM supporters were undaunted, despite two subsequent failed attempts to restore those stolen LPFM stations over a decade of struggle. And finally, just last month, on December 18, 2010, Congress finally approved the long-overdue expansion of LPFM. But jumping back now to the 1950s, radio at that time in the 1950s was considered the sideshow to the main media phenomenon, television, a medium long hyped with positive potential. My favorite quote is that of David Sarnoff, the founder of NBC, who in 1939 said, quote, "It is probable that the television drama of high caliber and produced by first-rate artists will materially raise the level of dramatic taste of the nation," unquote. He was a little bit off. There was some struggle over the direction of TV, but it was basically from industry. Which industry would call the shots? Would it be the radio industry, who had the leg up on one-to-many broadcasting? Would it be the movie industry, which was versed in the visual oeuvre? The public was barely involved in the decision, and the result was shamefully corrupt. In 1946, FCC Chair Charles Denny, a Democrat, pushed for and wound up approving a plan giving near monopoly control of television to NBC and CBS. 6 months later, Denny left the FCC to become an executive and general counsel at NBC, tripling his salary. But efforts to chip away at that monopoly control of TV continued in the coming years, including, ironically enough, from the FCC itself. In the 1940s, the FCC proposed a strict proposal of public interest broadcast obligations, referred to as the Blue Book. That helped to lead to policies like the Fairness Doctrine, which sought to break the tedium of perspectives on the airwaves. Newton Minow, FCC chair under President Kennedy and Northwestern University alum and later faculty, gave a 1961 speech entitled Television and the Public Interest to the National Association of Broadcasters. In that speech, he famously decried television as a vast wasteland. In fact, TV producer Sherwood Schwartz later admitted to naming the SS Minow from the TV show Gilligan's Island as a jab against Minow, the FCC chair. Minow, the FCC chair, nonetheless pushed through a mandate that all TV sets receive UHF signals, thus opening the possibility for more TV stations. That, as well as the burgeoning social movements in the 1960s, and a critical 1967 report by the Carnegie Commission on Educational Television, finally broke the resistance of the NAB to the establishment of public broadcasting in the U.S. The result was the passage of the Public Broadcasting Act, which came only 45 years after the establishment of a public broadcaster in Britain. But the independent financing potential of public broadcasting in the U.S. was muted when a proposal to fund public broadcasting using an excise tax from the sale of TV sets was not included in the final act. Public broadcasting without that independent funding base thus became the ugly stepsister to its commercial brethren, getting their programming, only that programming that commercial broadcasters couldn't make any money off of. Some of that potential was ultimately realized with the establishment of public access broadcasting on cable television, which did accord more independent funding and thus greater autonomy. Cable TV, along with satellite television later, widened the number of ostensible TV channels available to a wider public. But concurrent with that trend, there occurred another trend from about 1980 on of the shrinking of ownership across the entire media landscape. As we've seen, there was media concentration before the 1980s, but for the most part, that was concentration that was restricted to a small number of players within a given media industry. In the 1980s, companies started to build conglomerates across media industries so that it wasn't just a TV producer or a film studio or a newspaper publisher. It was a TV producer and a film studio and a newspaper publisher and much more besides. The raison d'être was, as usually is, profit. More profit can be generated by producing content once and then redistributing it along all of one's channels. So then a race was underway to consolidate media across industries, aided by zealots in government subscribing to supposed free market principles, but instead aiding and abetting the formation of the greatest media monopolies heretofore seen. The greatest chronicler of this new consolidation trend was Ben Bagdikian, former editor at the Washington Post and dean emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. In 1983, Bagdikian published a book called The Media Monopoly, which noted that there were just 50 companies which commanded the lion's share of media in the United States, and that the trend was to consolidate further, perhaps to as few as 6 media companies. The book was republished in updated editions 7 times in the next 2 decades to chronicle the continuing changes in the American media landscape. By the time the 7th edition came out in 2004, Bagdikian wound up being wrong in one respect. It didn't get down to as few as 6 media companies. In that book, he listed just 5. Bagdikian and many others also chronicled the negative consequences of such concentration. Increased commercialism, less journalism, less independence from the bottom line, more conflicts of interest, fewer diverse perspectives, and even life or death situations, as was the case in the city of Minot, North Dakota, which in 2002 saw a chemical leak from a train derailment which caused hundreds to be hospitalized. And when local police tried to get on the radio to alert the public, they found that 6 of the 7 Minot radio stations were coming from being broadcast from a single clear channel office in Minot, which was unstaffed at the time of the leak. The response to this trend of media concentration crystallized arguably the most dynamic, successful, and inspiring media reform effort in a generation, the Media Ownership Uprising of 2003.
That was the first part of a 2-part presentation I gave entitled Corporate Media Control and Media Reform Struggles, given on January 16, 2011. The second part of the presentation will air on the next episode of The Ministry of Truth.
Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.